Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. Happy New Year, everyone. I'm not sure that we'll have a whole lot of happiness to anticipate in the course of this year, but we will do our best to at least make sure it doesn't take you by surprise, that's for sure. In fact, I'm mindful that in the immediate aftermath of a terrible earthquake in Japan, that we are likely to experience a lot of, if you will, geostrategic tectonic shifts taking place. Some of them we can't anticipate, but some we see coming. And if we have the wit and the will to take appropriate steps, like, you know, hardening buildings against the possibility of a physical earthquake, we may be able to attenuate the damage that is otherwise going to come our way. A prime example of this, to my way of thinking, is a topic we've discussed a lot in the last year, and we're going to be spending some time on over the next 5 months, because in May, the United States government and assorted others around the world, the Chinese Communist Party, the World Economic Forum, the European Union, Bill Gates, Big Pharma, are all going to try to see what they can do to engineer agreements that will repose in the World Health Organization powers that are clearly at odds with, incompatible with our sovereignty, as well as our personal medical freedoms. And that would be to give the Secretary General of the World Health Organization the authority to say, you have a public health emergency of international concern, and not only do you have one, but this is what you must do about it. Now, I don't know about you folks, but if you didn't think that the advice that we were treated to from the World Health Organization during the recent pandemic unpleasantness was very helpful, in fact, to the contrary, it brought us the China model of lockdowns and jabs and isolation and the rest. You're not going to like what they are able to do if they actually are able not simply to advise, but to tell us what we must do. Now, interestingly enough, last month, not one, not two, but three different senior officials of the Biden administration, I believe, perjured themselves, having taken an oath to tell the truth and nothing but the truth. They told the Congress that, oh, there's actually no problem with our sovereignty arising from these agreements. That's not so. Fortunately, the House of Representatives adopted legislation that defunds the World Health Organization and requires, before it gets any more, that the Senate of the United States advise and consent to any of these agreements that are now in the works and are supposed to come to fruition in May. The House and the Senate must adopt this legislation, and the president must sign it into law. We'll be working, I hope, with your help to accomplish that. That's the briefing. We're going to turn next to our friend and very valued colleague, Bill Walton, the host of The Bill Walton Show. He is, I'm proud to say, our first guest of the new year, the working new year. We had Tommy Waller on yesterday in the show that ran on day one, but Bill Walton is not only an extraordinary contributor to the public policy debate through his wonderful podcast program, which I commend to all of you. He also brings a lot of experience, some of which we're going to tap in the course of a very important conversation about, a new topic to me since we last were doing live programs, and that is something called natural asset companies. And Bill's been going to school a bit on it, and we're very pleased to have him with us to talk a bit about it. What's up with all of this? Bill Walton, welcome back. It's good to have you, sir, especially for a time such as this.
Happy New Year. We have some work ahead of us this year, Frank, but we're up to it.
We've got wood to chop, as our friend Steve Bannon says. Let's talk a little bit about these so-called NACs, natural asset companies, Bill. What does that mean, and what's their provenance?
Well, a natural asset company is the latest invention of the climate radicals to really reduce our living standards back to the, you know, somewhere around the Dark Ages. And Frank, you had a fantastic webinar last week with six guests on who I thought were just extraordinary that covered this. I think we ought to give a plug for that. If you go to the Committee on Present Danger website and take a look at the first webinar, it's well worth the hour that you'll spend with it, because that'll give an overview of it that I can't do in the time we have right here. But essentially, a natural asset company is something that's been invented to capture the value of natural assets, as they call it, which essentially means the value of land if you leave it completely undeveloped. And the climate lobby has been very concerned that the agricultural industry, the mining industry, real estate development industry, those companies, those entities, oil and gas in particular, anything that extracts useful minerals from the earth, well, those are not, in fact, useful, and they are useful to human beings, but they're damaging to the earth. And so they've worked on this idea of creating carbon emissions as a liability. And the problem is companies are mounting up with carbon emission liabilities, but they've got no way to offset it, which gives rise to a need for a new asset, which they've invented, and they're calling it a natural asset company. And who's behind this? It's called the Intrinsic Exchange Group that's come up with this, and they're working in partnership with the New York Stock Exchange, who, guess what, is backed by the Rockefeller Group, which is an extremely woke left-wing foundation. And they've tried to sneak this they've tried to birth it into existence in a very stealthy way. If for all of us who don't curl up with a Federal Register, they announced this, and I have a copy of it here, Federal Register, October 4th, close to my birthday, 2023, and they announced that they're asking for approval from the SEC to create this kind of entity. And they gave a comment period that was extremely short, maybe one of the shortest comment periods anybody can recollect. And so they're hopeful to get this done. Frank, I don't know who caught them red-handed, but somebody did, and many of us are springing into action to bring this to a halt. And, you know, one of the action items for anybody listening to this would be to log on to your website and take a look at the letter to the SEC that we would like people to sign. You have to do some of your own writing yourself, but
sovereigtycoalition.org. And Bill, let me just interrupt to say, I failed in this particular version of your bio, which it's hard to do justice to in the shortness of a show like this, but you've got considerable experience with the SEC and with financial initiatives like this. You ran for, as I understand, 14 years or so,
I ran a New York Stock Exchange company that was heavily regulated by the
Allied Capital
Business Development Company. And I had my good experiences and not so good experiences with the SEC, but in the end, we came out all right.
You made money is the key thing. But Bill, just on this point, this proposed rule, as they call it, that the SEC is now considering, and they had to extend the comment period from 21 days, as you say, a very, very truncated, stealthy kind of thing, to I think it's now the 18th of January, and maybe a little bit longer for a rebuttal period. But Bill, the point is that what these guys are trying to do is to conjure up, kind of out of whole cloth, like I call it alchemy, value from air. No kidding. And we have to take a short break. When we come back, Bill, I want to just ask you, how can they apply accounting principles to the evaluation of these assets? Or do they have to change the rules of that as well? We'll be right back with more with Bill Walton. Stay tuned.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. A devastating earthquake in Japan yesterday may symbolize a new year marred by geostrategic tectonic shifts. Some are predictable, and their effects can therefore be attenuated if we act in time. Consider the creation of so-called global governance mechanisms that would subordinate us to the dictates of unaccountable international entities like the World Health Organization. Largely secret negotiations are expected by May to produce agreements that will give the WHO the authority to declare what constitutes a public health emergency here and what must be done about it. Three Biden administration officials appear to have perjured themselves in testifying last month that would not diminish our sovereignty. The House of Representatives has voted to cut off funding for the WHO and require Senate approval of any such accords to prevent irreparable harm to our public health and America. Congress must concur. This is Frank Affney.
We're back. Bill Walton is with us, I'm very pleased to say, and I left you hanging by leaving the question unanswered as to how can companies, how can a company, a natural asset company as it's called, that doesn't produce anything, whose sole mission is to apparently keep things from being usefully done with land, for example, or water, or air for that matter, federal or state or local government lands, for example, how can they be valuable? How can it make sense to invest in them, as you know that business very well?
Well, I think one of the ways you do it is you invent voodoo accounting. One of my other claims to fame, Frank, is I worked my way through business school teaching accounting to undergraduate accounting majors. And in the good old days, to
you're actually a CPA by training.
I could have been. I didn't want to take the test. I was on to other things. I figured out anything that needed me to be a CEA, I didn't want to do. Anyway, so I've known about this for about 72 hours, thanks to you, and I've studied what we've got in the webinar. But let's see if we can boil this down. They want to create a company that invests in real estate, but the stipulation is that the real estate is not, and this is reading from the Federal Register, is not to be put into any productive use. In other words, the uses I mentioned at the outset. And they say by preserving it as an ecosystem in aggregate, if you take a look at all the earth, all the value in the United States, they're estimating that the value is $100 trillion per year. And so you quickly ask yourself, where does that value come from? Well, it comes from, and you look at the footnotes, it comes from all these totally left-wing climate change groups. The Paulson Institute, Cornell Atkinson Center for Sustainability, Global Sustainable Investment Alliance, you get the gist. And they refer you to the United Nations. The United Nations, of course, is involved in this. And along the way, they've cooked up a system of environmental economic accounting. And I highly recommend it to all of you fellow wonks to take a look at this website. It's easily found at seea.un.org. And it gets into ecosystem accounting. And essentially, they take a look at the square yards you have, or the square meters you have, or square miles. And they take a look at the volume of air. And they take a look at the habitat that's there, and they attribute a value to it, and that's supposed to become the tradable value. But it there's no cash flow. In fact, these companies will be disqualified from this designation if they do invest in something productive. The risk here is that they've also got the Bureau of Land Management involved with this, and a couple of other federal agencies. And recollect, the Biden administration has said, we want a whole of government approach to climate change. And every agency in government has been weaponized to bring this about. And,
let me just interrupt on that point, if I may, because one of the really stunning things that was mentioned by one of our participants, Margaret Byfield, of the American Stewards for Liberty organization, I'd not met her before this exchange, but she said that the the kind of tell in all of this was that early on in the administration, John Kerry, the climate change czar, pronounced that within 18 months, they were going to make the whole climate change agenda of this administration, quote, irreversible, unquote. And what it sounds like you're saying about these companies, Bill, is that that would be their role, that they would essentially lock down presumably large quantities of this kind of real estate, especially if the federal government is going to wind up putting them in control of them.
Well, that's exactly right. They do want to lock it down. And one of your guests had a great quote. He said, this climate crisis narrative has reached a dangerous point where proponents seem to be willing to starve and freeze people to death so they don't die from climate change. And I can smile at that, but this is deadly serious, Frank. If they get control of these parcels of land they want to buy, we're going to end up let's look at what's happened in the Netherlands with the farmers there. They decided the cows produce methane, and so they're therefore trying to shut down dairy farming in the Netherlands. This is just one example of how that would play out. They would basically take a look at all land use. And another example is if a farmer somehow put their land in a conservation easement, which I don't recommend if you're a farmer, the federal agency or the state agency that controls that easement could then sell the rights to that to one of these natural asset companies.
So that's how they get their hands on private land and its use.
That's one of the public. Three or four ways they do it. All of us are getting up to speed of in this in a hurry, so I'm probably at the tip of the iceberg. The other point I wanted to make is one of your guests, James Lindsay, who's our resident expert in critical race theory and social Marxism and theory. You know, he says this is right out of the Karl Marx playbook. This idea has been around for 150 years, and it's been a dream of the left to somehow take agricultural assets and turn them into so-called natural assets, thereby making them unusable by human beings and allowing us to flourish. Of course, the flora and fauna would flourish, but they'd be awfully lonely because all the people would be dead.
You know, this is relevant to the brief that I gave earlier, because one of the things that is enshrined in this whole World Health Organization agenda, and it's part of this UN apparatus, after all, is this idea of one health. One health meaning that it's not just human health that one needs to be governed by the World Health Organization, it's plant and animal health as well. So this all fits in, doesn't it?
Well, they've tried to do this in my old years of, you know, corporate public company. They tried to move the standard from shareholder capitalism to stakeholder capitalism. And what that does is it becomes unmeasurable, because then all of a sudden, instead of returning cash to your investors, you're in the business of providing benefit to everybody in the community and in the country. And it would really have been an incredibly destructive effect on capital allocation and the way the markets work. But that's their goal.
That's the agenda.
Absolutely.
So we've got an arrangement whereby they're going to essentially be taking over this land. They're going to be compelling its all left fallow, essentially. They're going to be using some new conjured up accounting system to assign value to it. And in the end of the day, we're going to see and it was, by the way, not just somebody, it was the treasurer of the state of Utah who made that analysis, that you're going to find people starving and freezing to avoid climate change.
Well, Frank, in the territory you and I usually cover, which is China, you ask yourself, who would buy a company that produces no cash flow? Well, people who would buy the company or buy assets or shares or invest in the company would be entities which did not want to see the United States develop its natural assets. That might be China. That might be Iran. That might be Saudi Arabia. It might be anybody who wants to see us not
to harm us. Yeah, exactly. Bill, we're almost out of time. Just a quick question. Among those is Russia. What would be the implications if we seize Russian T-bill holdings?
Well, there's $300 billion of so-called liquid assets, which Biden and Blinken and Nuland and Sullivan are the four stooges who run our foreign policy, think that could finance the Ukraine war because they can't get money from Congress. Well, if we take over the dollar assets or the reserve assets of Russia, every other single country in the world is going to say, we can no longer trust this system. We've got to get out of the dollar, and it's game over.
It's game over. The dollar will no longer be the reserve currency of the world, and it will happen very quickly. I think you're absolutely right. Bill, thank you. We have to let you go. We want you to stay tuned, folks. We're going to have an important takeaway at the end of the program. Stay with us for more right after this.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome and happy new year to our friend and colleague from north of our border. Her name is Christine Douglas-Williams. She is a Canadian journalist of considerable accomplishment, both in front of the camera and behind it. She has won numerous awards for her work as a journalist, international awards, no less. She is also the author of The Challenge of Modernizing Islam, a topic that we're very interested in touching on with her here, and also one entitled Fired by the Canadian Government for Criticizing Islam. Book from our Center for Security Policy Press, also relevant to today's topics. Christine, it's good to have you with us once again. I hope your holidays were good and you're braced for impact this year.
It was, and Happy New Year, Frank.
Thank you very much. So, Christine, one of the things that you have impressed upon us, we shouldn't need it, but it's always helpful to have you pointing it out. What happens on the other side of that border almost certainly is going to have an impact on our side of it, not least because it's a completely porous border. So talk to us a little bit about reports that the Canadian government is welcoming in some numbers of some categories, at least, of Gazan refugees into your part of North America.
First of all, Frank, just the mere notion of welcoming in Gazan refugees, nobody knows where they stand. We could suspect where they stand in terms of politics because support for Hamas among Palestinians, period, soared, unfortunately, since October 7th. So that's one thing. But there was a broader kind of a suspicion that Canada was going to open its doors to the Gazans, period. Not quite so. It's to immediate family members. You're looking at siblings, moms, dads, grandparents, sons, daughters, and that kind of a thing. However, with that said, there's also another way of applying for permanent residency in Canada under the Canadian Experience Class. All you need to do is work for a year, show relative knowledge of the language, and you could apply as a permanent resident. And from there, then you could start expanding who you bring into the country and end up with a multiplier effect. And let's face
it. This is called chain migration, I think, is the term for it. But it's it starts relatively small, but it expands considerably. We've seen that here, too. So, again, to your point, Christine, and you've made a deep study of Islam. You, of course, are also an important contributor to our friend Robert Spencer's wonderful online resource, jihadwatch.org. And you are very familiar with the problem, not of all Muslims, we always have to make that point, but of those who adhere to this doctrine of Sharia. And a lot of them do. And in particular, within the Gazan and the Palestinian community more generally, it's, you know, virtually everyone. So what does it likely mean if you start getting people who embrace this doctrine that not only legitimizes or justifies, but compels adherents to engage in jihad, or at least support it, to be migrating in significant numbers into Canada?
Frank, there are two quick points when it comes to what you just asked there. One is, it's no secret that Hamas actually aspires for global caliphate. That came out very clear. They are Muslim Brotherhood. That is number one. Another issue is...
And that's what Sharia commands.
That's what Sharia is. What Sharia is. Now, we also see that there have been enormous intimidating protests, pro-Palestinian protests in America and in Canada as well. Many malls, the Eaton Center is one of them in Toronto. There was a picture of, I mean, this was really ridiculous, of a child sitting on Santa's knee and all these Palestinian protesters chanting, and they're waving these flags, and they shut down the Christmas season virtually. Yeah. And it's not just the
small airports and, you know, intersections and
Highway 401 is the biggest highway, the most busy highway in North America, believe it or not, and they shut down a major artery going into Avenue Road. Those who are familiar with Toronto would understand what that means. But police are talking about it, Frank. People are condemning it. They're concerned about the Jewish community and some of the words that's coming from these protests, this Zionist-infested area. But talk is cheap. Politicians are talking about it, condemning it, yet nobody shut down the protest, and that should have been shut down, knowing that they were blocking the roads and also spreading hate against the Jewish community.
And of course, you use the term Zionist infestation, quoting some of those that are demagoguing against Jews, the evidence of the anti-Semitism before significant numbers of these refugees arrive. And again, you're one of our duty experts on this phenomenon. Is it the case in Canada, as it certainly is here, that the Muslim Brotherhood and its apparatus is making common cause with those on the left to engage in this kind of, at best, disruptive behavior, and at worst, incipient violent and potentially very, very malevolent behavior at that?
Very much so. I mean, as you know, I got fired by the government of Canada, meaning the Trudeau government. I was a Harper appointee, but CARE-CAN is an offshoot of CARE. CARE
Council
Canada.
On American
and,
Islamic
and it became
Relations.
The National Council of Canadian Muslims. And they weighed in to the government when I was employed there as part of the government as an appointee, because I was writing for Jihad Watch. And I had made a speech in Iceland warning about the stealth tactics of Islamic supremacists, not all Muslims, but Islamic supremacists. And they made a hoopla, and that was how I got fired. Now we have an Islamophobia czar in the country overseeing what people are saying and doing when it comes to the area of Islam. Yet, what about the Jews?
Yeah.
And the Jews, church burnings that have been.
And again, what's happening there is to some extent already happening here, but it will almost certainly intensify, especially if you wind up. And I think, frankly, the Biden administration would love to do this too, to take Gazan refugees if they can figure out a way to do it. But at the moment, it's a little tricky given the problems with the border and the degree to which the American people have, you know, had it with asylum seekers and so on. Christine, let me pivot quickly to another topic. One of my favorite news outlets, the Epoch Times, has a piece in their print edition about Canadian government action against cows in your country and what that might entail or mean for not just the farmers of Canada, but also for the food supply, all on the grounds that, you know, these cows are terrible emitters of greenhouse gases and must be, you know, finished off. What is happening here? Have the environmentalists now just simply run amok in your country as they're trying
to? It's absolutely absurd. I mean, the Calgary Herald on that issue actually ran a headline: Ottawa comes down hard on methane burping cows or humans next. So the cows are passing gas and it's being seen as polluting the atmosphere. I mean, there's no end to this, which has become a green religion that has absolutely no basis. And I know there have been many that have made jokes about it. What are humans going to do? What are they going to do? Get rid of cows and have us eating bugs next? I mean, this is something that has come up in numerous areas. And
we are, after all, not only burping and otherwise passing gas ourselves, but as last time I checked, we're emitters of carbon dioxide.
Yes.
With every breath we take.
I mean, that are humans next.
Where does this go? Yeah. So, Christine, when you look at the sort of Canadian government's agenda, and it does seem as though it more or less mirrors that of Biden and the whole UN, you know, apparat and the climate change. You said religion. I'd say cult, really.
Yes.
Where is this likely to lead? Could it take us as far, do you think, as, say, the Netherlands, where, you know, farmers are now in extremis? I mean, talk about endangered species. That's pretty much what they are.
I'll tell you one thing. The Albertans are fighting hard. They're fighting the federal government. And there has been talk, I don't know how serious it is, behind the scenes, word of mouth, that the issue of separatism has come up again. I don't think it's serious at this moment. And one of the reasons I don't think it is, especially now, is that Trudeau's numbers are way, way down. He's already starting to contradict himself, scale back a little bit on the carbon tax, and then he comes forward again. The guy is beleaguered. And even traditionally, Trudeau supporting media are starting to come right out and say, look, this guy's days are over. And it's become a joke that even going into the new year that he's still there and he plans on staying until elections in 2025. So his numbers are way down. Pierre Poilievre is gaining popularity. Things are bad for Trudeau.
Now tell us about him. You've mentioned him previously on the program, but tell us a little bit more about this opposition leader.
Pierre Poilievre is being touted as a hope in Canada, and he really is. I mean, he is a conservative to the core, and conservative meaning conservative values. He, when it comes to the economy, he's obviously a man that will fiscal spending is one thing that we know in the conservative camp is much less than you would find with a liberal government who spends everybody's money. So already he is talking big time about the economy, the nonsense about the whole green movement. All of the issues, what really made him gain popularity and come into being the leader of the Conservatives is when the truckers were protesting in Ottawa, he actually stood by the truckers because he felt that Canadian freedoms were being violated, and he was absolutely right. How interesting now that Trudeau was not cracking down on the pro-Palestinians, but he cracked down on the truckers.
Yeah, it turns out that there are approved people for hate,
yes,
and there are people that you must not deign to speak ill of. Christine Douglas-Williams, as always, we appreciate so much your clarity on all of these issues. We love the work you do at jihadwatch.org. I know you'll keep it up, and I look forward to visiting with you often in the new year.
Always
God bless
a pleasure,
you, Frank. We'll talk soon. We'll be right back with Colonel Chuck DeVore right after this.
This is Frank Effney with the Secure Freedom Minute. A devastating earthquake in Japan yesterday may symbolize a new year marred by geostrategic tectonic shifts. Some are predictable, and their effects can therefore be attenuated if we act in time. Consider the creation of so-called global governance mechanisms that would subordinate us to the dictates of unaccountable international entities like the World Health Organization. Largely secret negotiations are expected by May to produce agreements that will give the WHO the authority to declare what constitutes a public health emergency here and what must be done about it. Three Biden administration officials appear to have perjured themselves in testifying last month that would not diminish our sovereignty. The House of Representatives has voted to cut off funding for the WHO and require Senate approval of any such accords to prevent irreparable harm to our public health and America. Congress must concur. This is Frank Effney.
Welcome back. We're joined, I'm pleased to say, by Lieutenant Colonel Chuck DeVore, United States Army Reserves. He's been retired for some time, but he is one of the people whose training in military intelligence has abided as a very important feature of the work that he's gone on to do, notably as a state assemblyman in California, and now as the chief of national initiatives at the Texas Public Policy Foundation in Austin, Texas. We're always glad to catch up with him, but especially to introduce the new year and what's ahead for us. Colonel, it's good to have you with us. Welcome back, sir.
Great to be back, Frank.
I wanted to start by sort of keying off of something I talked about at the top of the show, which is, we had this apparently rather profound earthquake in the western part of Japan, and it seems as though that might somewhat symbolize what might be ahead of us this year. A lot of geostrategic tectonic shifting is in the mix, and part of it is, as I see it, Chuck, a desire, an ambition, an intent by the Chinese Communist Party on the one hand, and among others, I suppose, their Russian surrogates and proxies, no limits partners, to remake the world, to reorder it, to tailor it to their taste. Is that in prospect, do you think? And what does that portend?
Well, they certainly are trying hard to do that, Frank. I think you're seeing with some of the trade between Russia and China, kind of the emerging hints of that, right? Where there was a cap put on the value of Russian oil exports. And so what Russia has done is adjusted significantly. And instead of supplying Western Europe with energy, they're supplying China and secondarily India with cheap oil. Interestingly enough, Frank, a lot of that oil being sent to China is now going not only over pipeline into China, along with a lot of natural gas, but also through the Arctic. So the Northwest Passage is finally becoming a thing. With, of course, Russia's very robust icebreaker fleet and the desire of the Chinese to be able to get some oil without it going through the strategic choke point at the Strait of Malacca down by Singapore. So you're beginning to see that. Of course, you're also seeing countervailing efforts as well with the new president of Argentina announcing his exit from BRICS, which is not helpful to China and to Russia. Insofar as their effort to create a global alternative to what they see as a U.S. Western hegemony with the U.S. dollar underpinning most of global trade.
Yeah, we talked a bit about that earlier in the program, and it's an interesting question as to whether what we're doing under the Biden administration to, destroy the value of the dollar is going to be more than offset by some of the wheels coming off the BRICS program, uprooting formulae, to say the least. But Chuck, let me ask you a bit more about this issue of the tectonic shifting. One of the things that's been reported recently is the growing evidence that the Chinese really are on a war footing with respect to military procurement, among other things, notably an unbelievably aggressive pursuit of warship construction. What can you tell us about that, and how does that compare to the footing we're on?
Yeah, so the U.S., of course, has allowed its shipbuilding capacity to largely atrophy over the years. You know, we tend to build ships that are of very high quality, but they're very expensive. And because of our own domestic policies and the strength of our unions, et cetera, it's very costly to operate U.S. Vessels. And so what you end up with is the vast majority of the world's trade is conducted on ships that are not flagged under the U.S. and certainly not operated by U.S. crews. Now, this obviously redounds down to military construction as well. And so, again, the U.S. does continue to have the largest fleet in the world when it comes to tonnage. That's the amount of, you know, the weight of the ships afloat. But China certainly has a larger fleet when it comes to the number of hulls. And more disturbingly, if you look at the age of the hulls, the age of the Chinese military fleet is considerably younger than the age of the U.S. fleet. And so essentially, we have been living off of the legacy of our Cold War victory over the Soviet Union for many decades now. We have these great supercarriers, which still have no equivalent in the world. But other than that, Frank, what you're seeing is China is rapidly catching up, and at the rate that they are building ships, they will likely eclipse the U.S. in total tonnage, certainly by the end of this decade, unless we reverse course very quickly, which, frankly, I just don't see the political will to do in Washington, D.C. yet to do that.
Yeah, this was featured in the Wall Street Journal piece today. Chuck, the thing that I was struck by in this article was the not only the size of these shipyards that the Chinese have amassed, many of them for the production of, you know, it seems limitless numbers of various kind of commercial vessels, but now also increasingly warships, is the fact that they have apparently been running them 7 days a week, 24 hours, three shifts a day to crank these things out. And I think it was, if I'm not mistaken, the case that they've got something like 80 of these warships that they have constructed in the space of the past 8 years. And to your point, the old line about, you know, tonnage or quality, I think it was Stalin who said quantity has a quality all its own. And right. In fact, in a shooting war, it may well be that what you need are more ships, even if they're smaller, even if individually they're less capable right. than a few very, very capable, but very sinkable ones, like perhaps supercarriers. Chuck, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to visit a little bit further about this contrast between the status, I guess, of our respective countries and whether that's an inducement to aggression on the part of the Chinese Communist Party. We'll get into that and more with Lieutenant Colonel Chuck DeVore right after this. Back, we are continuing a very important conversation at the new year with Lieutenant Colonel Chuck DeVore, the author, among other things, of The Crisis of the House Never United, and a personal, somewhat older favorite of mine, China Attacks. And I've just learned, I'm very gratified to say, that there is an updated version of it in the works, China Attacks 2024, which sounds to me is about right. Chuck, say a word about this book in process and how you're making it available as it emerges.
Yeah, right now, Frank, it's basically available on Kindle as kind of an early edition. So if you buy it on Kindle, as the book gets updated and moves to completion, you'll always be able to update for free to the latest version. And then eventually, of course, it'll be out in physical form as it marches to completion.
What a cool idea. I've never heard of this being done before.
Figured, you know, I mean, part of what I'm trying to do with these books is raise public awareness through a different venue, right? Not everyone watches your wonderful program, Frank, but some people would rather read a techno-thriller novel, right? And so I'm trying to reach people where they are. And it also allows me to think about things as I used to as an intelligence officer, right, as wargaming things. And you're trying to think through how things might look or how you might use the assets at your disposal if you're the enemy. And so then I end up putting that thinking into a novel form. And I just find it a useful way to kind of organize my thoughts and get it out on paper.
That has the other advantage, Chuck, of, as I personally fear, that this balloon, as they say, not the weather kind or even the surveillance kind, but the proverbial balloon of war goes up sometime in the near future. You have the advantage of having this thing out there already to some extent. So congratulations on that. So Chuck, I did want to just double back briefly, and I forgot to mention that I'm going to have to take a short pause towards the end to make a takeaway, which is one of our features of the program now. But just on this point about what is the relative status of our, well, militaries, yes, but also our civilian societies, given that, as I understand it, Xi Jinping has been making no secret of his efforts to sort of ready his team for a shooting kind of war, and I haven't seen any sign of that being done on this side of the pond. Your thoughts?
Right. Well, both the People's Republic of China under the Chinese Communist Party and America and its allies both have their own unique advantages and disadvantages, right? So China has been engaged in this massive military buildup. Most of the West has been ignoring it and certainly hasn't yet internalized the implications or the kind of wishing it away. Russia's war on Ukraine has allowed for a very unique ability for China now to significantly ramp up its production of materiel that would be useful in the war. And in exchange is getting very cheap oil, very cheap energy from Russia. So they're one of the few countries that's directly benefiting from this war between Russia and Ukraine. And in the
meantime, no accident, comrade, I would argue.
Right. Right, exactly. And in the meantime, you have America with its legacy military, a military that's extremely battle-tested, but against non-peer enemies in places like Afghanistan and Iraq and the war on terror that's kind of this war without end. But unfortunately, Frank, because of the huge costs for that, we've allowed our research and development to atrophy. We've allowed our procurement to atrophy. And so our military is getting, it's kind of worn at the edges, and its equipment is getting old and is less effective relative to a peer adversary than it used to be. And we've also run up these huge deficits. Of course, so has China. And so you have the two most powerful nations on the planet, each with their own unique advantages, as well as very similar weaknesses when it comes to this massive debt, both countries have amassed. The huge difference, of course, being that China's hit this demographic bomb where they are imploding and from a long-term standpoint are less viable than the U.S. Because we do have a higher birth rate. And unlike China, we have this massive immigration, both legal and illegal. No one, it appears, wants to actually move to China, whereas it seems like half the world wants to move here. And that has its own advantages and disadvantages.
Yeah.
Well, right. And a lot of military-aged Chinese men now have been coming across the border for the last year. And of course,
probably
we know—
Probably not for a better life, though.
Well, it's hard to tell because there's this very high youth unemployment rate in China because of Xi Jinping's wrongheaded policies. On the other hand, they're military age.
Yeah, and they seem to be pretty fit, and they're moving in units and all that. Chuck, we have to leave it at that for the moment. This is a really important conversation to which we will return with you, I hope, on a number of occasions in the new year. I want to thank you for what you're doing to work this through at China Attacks 2024. Let me just pivot quickly to our takeaway, folks. There's breaking news as we speak about the Israeli Supreme Court striking down judicial reform that was enacted democratically on the basis of a mandate given to the Netanyahu coalition to do just that. The Supreme Court's found this effort to pair some of their powers, which they have assumed unilaterally, to be unreasonable. So they've said you can't restrict us in any way. I think we will be hearing more about this, but apparently not for the duration of the war in Gaza at the moment and perhaps elsewhere. This will be, unfortunately, an evidence of, I'm afraid, a very undemocratic operation going on in the Israeli government, one that is not serving the people well. But there is a unity government, including people who were trying desperately to topple the Netanyahu regime previously, and they're now inside the government, so nothing will happen for a little bit other than more application by these justices of what they call the reasonableness standard. Our government has been, I think, entirely supportive of this anti-democratic activity, albeit dressed up as protecting democracy. And I fear that it's kind of what they have in mind for us, too, if only they could pull it off, finding a new Supreme Court, finding a way to make it an engine of the democratic administration of Joe Biden, for example. We'll be following this closely, folks, as will you, I know. But stay tuned for that and much more next time with us here at Securing America. In the meantime, go forth and multiply.